Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Christ Church. We are very excited to have you here for a special edition of Paradox Class. We are going to be doing an apologetics basic course with Dr. Hugh Ross. This is going to run for about 6 weeks until February 17th, every Sunday morning at this time, 9 o'clock. What is apologetics? Apologetics is a rational defense of the faith. It is something that is vitally needed in this Christian, in our Christian world now. A lot of people have the experience of Christ in their heart, but many people need to know that the faith is founded in rational fact, in history, in philosophy, and in science. What is the first apologetic fact? First apologetic fact is that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead. St. Paul says that without that, our faith is in vain, and we are going to die in our sins. So the first apologetic fact is the resurrection. That's an astounding thing. It's really what verifies all the beliefs that we have about who Jesus is and all of his claims. We have with us this morning one of the most prominent scientific apologists in the world, Dr. Hugh Ross. He's going to be teaching this morning. Dr. Ross has a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia and a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He's founder and president of Reasons to Believe, an organization in Covina that integrates science and our faith. He's the author of many, many books, more than I can count anymore. And a lot of them are over there on the book table if you're interested. Feel free to go over there after the class and take a look. We have some goodies in the back. You're welcome to get up and partake. But remember that we are live streaming, so try to be quiet. And the cameras are high enough. I don't think anybody's tall enough to walk into those cameras, so I think we're good. Hugh Ross is going to be doing about 30 or 35 minutes of a talk on basic apologetics, and he's asking that he breaks tradition with the class that we don't do any questions until after his talk. So give him a chance to lay it all out, and then you can ask him the tough questions. There will be quite a bit of time for Q&A, so don't feel like he's going to duck out. At 10:45, we're going to be doing another special class with Robert Cavolo on C.S. Lewis. So if you love this, and you love C.S. Lewis, it's going to be a perfect morning for you. So I'm not going to say anything more. Please give a round of applause to Dr. Hugh Ross.
Okay, well, thank you. And as advertised, this is going to be an introduction to science and faith, how to integrate the book of nature with the book of scripture. And I will be missing for one of the six talks. That will be next week. I'll be speaking in Vancouver. But we're going to have a special guest. Dave Sargent's going to give the talk on the origin of soulish animals. And I typically give that talk, but he's going to give it with actual live animals. So there'll actually be animals right here. So the animals I work with aren't well enough behaved that I can get away with that. So, but he can. So I'll be just missing just this next week. And the five messages I've chosen are the five scientific evidences that have proven to be most effective in bringing non-theistic scientists and engineers to faith in Christ. So I'm going to be hitting the big five: the origin of the universe, the origin of human beings, the origin of life. We're going to talk about beyond the cosmos. That'll be today's talk. And then how do you show that the early chapters of Genesis are in concordance with the latest findings of research science? So without further ado, and incidentally, part of the introduction, I am the president and founder of Reasons to Believe. And we have several scientists and theologians on our staff. And you're welcome to communicate with us through Facebook, Twitter, and all the rest of that social media stuff. We have our 24/7 YouTube channel. Incidentally, this talk that will be posted on YouTube later. And if you want to communicate with me, you can simply text Hugh on your smartphone to 31996, and that's your portal to get a lot of free videos, book chapters, articles, and much more. And you're also encouraged to engage me on Facebook and Twitter. I actually answer all the questions I get in both of those social media venues. And today's talk is going to be based on a book that I wrote, Beyond the Cosmos. It's now in its third edition. And we're giving away a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross, the chapter on how do you integrate God's predestination with human free will. But I've titled the talk Beyond the Cosmos. A subtitle would be God's Transdimensionality, how recent discoveries in astronomy and physics reveal the transcendent power and glory of God, the glory of God beyond the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. I'm going to begin with a quote from Fong Li Ji. You say, who is he? He is China's most famous scientist. He passed away a couple of years ago, probably more famous for being one of the leaders of the Tiananmen Square protests, and he had to finish his last years at Arizona State University. But he wrote a book with his wife in which he said, quote, a question that has always been considered a topic of metaphysics or theology, the creation of the universe, has now become an area of active research in physics. And actually, I've written several books demonstrating that you'll see over there at the table. However, probably what he was referring to, he was a theoretical physicist, is what we refer to as the space-time theorems. And that's what catapulted Stephen Hawking to worldwide fame back in 1970, along with Roger Penrose. He published the first of the space-time theorems, which basically proves that if the universe contains mass, and as I look at all of you, each one of you is living evidence that indeed the universe does contain mass, a few of you a little more so than others. If the universe contains mass, and if general relativity describes accurately the movements of bodies in the universe, then space and time must be created, implying a causal agent that transcends space and time. And when Hawking and Penrose published this paper, we didn't have complete confidence in the theory of general relativity, but today we do. General relativity ranks as the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in all of physics, which means there really must be this causal agent who transcends space and time. Now, this didn't sit too well with a number of theoretical physicists who took a non-theistic worldview perspective. And so over the course of the last 40 years, they've been working to try to find some way to look at the universe where we don't have to have this agent beyond space and time creating everything. But in the process, they wound up producing even more powerful space-time theorems. Today, we have over 30 of them. And I actually brought one with me. If you want to take a look at it, if you're fans of tensor calculus, I think you'll really be pleased. But it ends with a conclusion that we can all understand. Any universe that expands on average has a beginning, implying a causal agent outside space and time that creates space, time, matter, and energy. Now, to be clear, they did find some ways of looking at the universe where they didn't have this causal agent. However, these were models of the universe that would not permit the existence of life. Life is only possible in a universe that expands on average throughout its history. And if the universe expands on average throughout its history, then indeed we have this causal agent beyond space and time. Alexander Vilenkin wrote the following about a year after he participated in this space-time theorem, not yet a believer, but this is what he said. Quote, with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Now, what is that problem? A God beyond space and time created the universe. We are stuck with that problem, whether we like it or not, based on the fact that physics now proves that indeed such an agent exists. However, The Bible said it first, thousands of years ago. In fact, the opening statement in the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the Hebrew word for create, bara, means to bring into existence something that never existed before. And what we see in the New Testament, Hebrews 11:3, the universe was formed at God's command. So what was seen was not made out of what was visible. What can we see and measure? Space, time, matter, and energy. And so here we see in both the New Testament and the Old Testament that God is claiming that he created the universe, and when he created it, he created space and time itself. And there's actually passages in the Bible that tell us explicitly that time has a beginning, just like our physicists have proven. 2 Timothy 1:9, this grace was given us in Christ Jesus before the beginning of time. Yes, according to the Bible, God was active before the beginning of time. Before he created the universe, he actually began his work of redeeming humanity from their sin and evil. Now, whenever I presented this before a university audience, or an audience made up of professional physicists and astronomers, a question I always get, if God created the universe, who created God? But you know, it's not just theoretical physicists that ask that question. Both of my sons, when they were 3.5 years of age, asked me that question. I think it's a question a lot of people ask. Okay, if God created the universe, who created God? Well, what I explained to my sons when they were 3.5 years of age is that the universe and everything in it, including all life in the universe, is constrained to one dimension of time. We're in time, and time goes forward. We can't make it go backward. It goes forward. It goes forward like it goes along a line. But God created time. Therefore, unlike the universe and all of us, he's not constrained by the dimension of time he created. And so what I shared with my sons is that time is that dimension in which things happen. Or for you who are better educated, time is that dimension in which cause and effect phenomena occur, where the causes take place or the effects take place after the causes. Notice the space-time theorem as the Bible is telling us that we've got a causal agent bringing the universe into existence before time exists. What does that imply? At a bare minimum, God is operating in the equivalent of two dimensions of time. Now, that's affirmed elsewhere in the Bible where it says that 1,000 years is like a day is like 1,000 years, 1,000 years is like 3 hours in the night. What that passage in Psalm 90 is telling us, God can arbitrarily expand time and arbitrarily compress time. And what I've shown in diagrams in my book, Beyond the Cosmos, that's only possible for a being who can operate in at least the equivalent of two dimensions of time. Well, what I shared with my sons when they were 3.5 is I kind of gave them like a little diagram. Okay, here we got two dimensions, length and width. But notice, we can have the timeline of the universe over here, and we can have God operating on a different timeline over here in this plane of time. And notice that timeline can be structured in such a way that it never crosses or touches the timeline of our universe. As such, God has no beginning and no ending in our line of time. And of all the holy books of the religions of the world, only the Bible says of God, no beginning and no ending. He eternally exists. Okay. Now, when I shared that with my sons, they said, okay, we got another one, Dad. How is it that you have us pray every night? I mean, what if there's all kinds of kids everywhere else in the world praying at the same time? How does God listen to all of our prayers at once? I said, that's a good question. You know, 7.5 billion of us all pray to God at the same time. Doesn't that jam up his phone lines? Well, he's not constrained to one dimension of time. And so I showed a different diagram to my sons, this one here, where I said, okay, here's the timeline of our universe. And at this point, 7.5 billion of us pray to God all at once. But because he has access to at least the equivalent of a second dimension of time, He can take infinite time perpendicular to our timeline and therefore give individual attention to 7.5 billion people that are praying simultaneously. Now, when I shared that with my sons at age 3.5, that gave them the confidence that when they were praying every night, God was actually hearing their prayers. So it's just something you can share with your kids and grandchildren and fellow friends. Okay. How many of you have heard of the Large Hadron Collider? Okay, it's in Switzerland and France. It's the biggest particle accelerator in the world. And they built that particle accelerator in order to find particles that what they called the standard model of particle physics had predicted. And it was at Caltech about 25 years ago where some friends of mine were working on particle physics theories. And what they discovered is there simply is not enough geographical room or spatial room within length, width, and height for all the symmetries demanded by quantum mechanics and gravity. And therefore, to make a self-consistent particle physics model, there had to be other space dimensions. And they knew that these dimensions would be extremely small, because basically what the model was saying is we have the universe expanding from the cosmic creation event with multiple dimensions of space. And at the point where gravity separates out from the other three forces of physics, this is when several of those space dimensions stop expanding. The three that continue to expand are length, width, and height. And so beginning 25 years ago, as a group of graduate students and professors, some of them who are participants in our paradoxes class here, who began to work on this problem. How many extra space dimensions do we need in order to have all these symmetries coexist so that life is possible in the universe? And they began by saying, well, we got to narrow it down. It's somewhere between 8 and 26 dimensions of space. And took another 10 or 11 years before they finally figured out what the right answer was. In addition to the three large dimensions of space, there are six small dimensions. So you may have thought we lived in a four-dimensional universe. We actually live in a nine-dimensional universe. Nine dimensions of space and one dimension of time, 10 space-time dimensions. Okay, now you may not have noticed these extra six space dimensions. That's because the cross-sections of these dimensions are no bigger than they were when gravity separated out from the other forces of physics, which means they're 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron. So that's why you don't really notice them as you walk around. All you experience are the big ones. But it raises a question. Where is this God that created all these space-time dimensions? Well, he must exist and operate both within and beyond the one time dimension and the nine space dimensions. He created them. So obviously he's free to operate independent of the 10 space-time dimensions, but having created them, he's actually able to operate within. Or to put it in a theological context, God is simultaneously and continuously both immanent and transcendent. Now, this is unique to the Christian faith. There are other religions of the world that teach that God is completely transcendent of the dimensions we experience. Islam would be an example. And the religions that teach that God is within our dimensions, but not beyond, Hinduism would be an example. But the Bible teaches that God is both and, not either or. And one passage that you can look at, can anyone hide in secret places so I cannot see him, declares the Lord? Do not I fill heaven and earth? You'll find that in the book of Jeremiah, basically stating that God is operating everywhere within his creation. Or what you see King David saying in Psalm 139, if I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. No matter where you go, to the depths of the sea, the highest mountains, the darkest places, God is there. He moves and operates everywhere. But we also have passages like you see in 1 Kings 8. The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain you. He is beyond. The Almighty is beyond our reach, Job declares. And then you got this passage from Paul in 1 Timothy. God, whom no man has seen nor can see. Basically making the point, it's impossible for us to touch God or see God, and yet he's everywhere around us. Many places you see this statement in Scripture, especially in the Psalms, the Lord is near. Or what you see in the book of Acts, he is not far from each one of us. So it raises a question, how can God be untouchable and invisible and yet very close to us in proximity? In fact, I can share this with you. Right now, God is closer to you than the next person next to you. And he's always that close to you. Wherever you go, God is in that close proximity to you, but you can't see him, you can't touch him. Okay, now, if I had time, I would explain to you why it's impossible to visualize phenomena and dimensions beyond what you can experience. I mean, for example, I could tell you you can take a basketball in four dimensions and turn it inside out without making a cut or a hole in the surface of the basketball. Can't be done in three dimensions, but you can do it in four dimensions. And I once took a mathematics course where the professor made us prove it with equations. None of us could visualize it, however. But yeah, what you can do, however, is visualize fewer dimensions than what you experience. And I'm going to do that to give you an analogy for the power of God and the dimensions we can't visualize. And to make that work, I've invited a handicapped couple up here to join me to help you with this demonstration. Their handicap is that, unlike you, they're missing one space dimension. They only have the dimensions of length and width, not height. So please welcome Mr. and Mrs. Flat, okay? And we're going to constrain them to a flat universe. So think of the top of this table here as being a flatland universe where there is just length and width and no height. Now it tells us, okay, let's see how Mr. and Mrs. Flat engage one another. Mrs. Flat looks at her husband. What does she see? She sees a line. Now, if she walks around him, she could see from this perspective two short lines. And she continues to walk around him. She can use her two-dimensional brain to calculate the outline of her husband. But she doesn't get that right away. Now, as a three-dimensional being, I don't have that handicap. I look at Mr. Flat, I immediately see the entire outline. I don't have to walk around him. I get it right away. Moreover, when I come close to them, I can put my hand 1 millimeter above Mr. and Mrs. Flat. I am now physically closer to them than they are to one another. But because I'm above their plane, it's impossible for them to see me or touch me. And notice, too, as a three-dimensional being, I get to see something they can never see about themselves. I get to see the inside. All they get to see is the outer outline, but I get to see the inside. Does that remind you of Bible passage? Okay. 1 Samuel. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. He knows us better than we know ourselves. That was a key point in my becoming a follower of Jesus Christ, was recognizing God knows better than I do what's best for me. Therefore, it only makes rational sense that I put him in charge of my life, because he knows me better than I know myself, and he knows what's best for me. Okay. You ever struggled with trying to figure out the doctrine of the Trinity? You know, my mother, for 30 years, resisted becoming a Christian because she was convinced the Trinity was a mathematical impossibility. How can God be three in one simultaneously? That's a mathematical contradiction. Every time I tried to explain it to her, she would interrupt me. Fortunately, I did a DVD once on the Trinity, and she couldn't interrupt me while she was watching it. So that helped. But to help you with that, let me take you back to Mr. and Mrs. Flat. The only way they can have any physical concept of who I am is if I come into their plane, which is what Jesus did. He left his heavenly realm and he came into our realm, the incarnation. But it's important to realize that Jesus of Nazareth was a sliver of the second person of the Trinity. He humbled himself and lowered himself. We weren't seeing the fullness of the deity because of the incarnation. An example of that is I could poke a finger through the plane. Mr. Flat would come and investigate, and he would conclude, I'm a small circle. He's only seeing a part of my being, an entity. Now, he would run home and tell his wife, I've had an encounter. Hugh Ross is a small circle. Isn't that wonderful? Okay. Next day, however, I come to Mrs. Flat, but this time I put three fingers through the plane. She rushes home to her husband and says, my dear, you are mistaken. It's three circles, not one circle. Of course, they wind up having a theological debate that lasts several hours. And what happens is, the next morning being Sunday, he goes off to the church of the one circle. She goes to the church of the three circles. What neither of them were able to recognize is this one finger and these three fingers are all part of a single closed three-dimensional surface. So in three dimensions, there is one context where I am three and another context where I am one. And that's the doctrine of the Trinity. One essence, three persons. These three persons have a single purpose, same set of attributes, character attributes, same mind, same plan. Now, I'm not claiming this totally resolves a paradox of the doctrine of the Trinity. It resolves a piece of it. Again, no one can visualize phenomena in dimensions they don't experience, but I think it helps people like my mother and others recognize, yes, it seems contradictory and is contradictory if we constrain God to just the dimensions of length, width, and height, but it's not a contradiction if we allow God to be as big as he is. And that's the principle about paradoxes, is that things would appear to be contradictory in our limited space-time frame become completely resolvable if we allow more dimensional room, just like with the particle physics. Same thing works with the Trinity. Okay, one that people have struggled with is this idea that God knows everything ahead of time, foreknowledge. Well, let's think of not only extra dimensions of space, but extra dimensions of time. So what I want you to visualize here is a sphere of time. So instead of time being a line, think of it like a globe, where you got the three dimensions of time. And this little red line here represents the timeline of our universe. But we could put God at the north pole of that sphere of time, and he can drop a perpendicular timeline to when he created Adam and Eve. He could drop another perpendicular timeline to when he created you, and a third perpendicular timeline when he's going to replace this universe with a new creation, a brand new realm. What I want you to notice is these three different positions of time along the timeline of a universe all come together at a single point or instant of time at the north pole of that sphere of time. So for example, we can pull those all back up and they meet at a single instant, demonstrating how God from a single instant of time can simultaneously know everything that's occurring along the entire timeline of your life and of the universe. But it tells us in the Bible, especially the book of Ephesians, God not only foreknows, he predetermines. He literally has predetermined before he created the universe everything you would think, everything you would say, everything you would do. Yet the Bible also declares that he holds you personally responsible for everything you think, say, and do. He's granted to every one of us human free will. At the same time, he's predetermined everything. Now, do not try to resolve that in length, width, height, and time. I devote a chapter in Beyond the Cosmos explaining why that's impossible. But if you allow God to be as big as what the physics declares, there are multiple ways God can predetermine everything and yet give every human being the freedom of choice and hold you responsible for your choices. And that's the free chapter we're giving away in Beyond the Cosmos just by going to reasons.org/Ross. And what I've done in that chapter is shown you three different ways you can have your cake and eat it too, where God can predetermine everything, and yet you have total free will. And incidentally, all three of my suggested solutions might be wrong, because in the context of God's transdimensionality, he's got an infinite number of ways that he can resolve that paradox. But I chose three just to make the point this is not a contradiction. This is important because, believe it or not, there is a war fought in the Netherlands where you had Christians on the free will side battling against Christians on the predestination side. There would have been no need for that war if they simply recognized what we know today in the 21st century. God transcends the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. Incidentally, the Bible declared that thousands of years ago, but now we've got the physics to prove that what the Bible said is correct. Now, this had a major factor in my becoming a Christian, because my story was I didn't really meet Christians till many years after I became one, and I became a Christian through studying astronomy and realizing there had to be a God that created the universe, and looking at the different religions, and looking at different holy books that undergirded those religions. But one of the things I noticed is every holy book outside of the Bible constrained God and his activities in a way we could visualize from the context of length, width, height, and time. The Bible stood alone in describing doctrines that were impossible to resolve in length, width, height, and time, which is one piece of evidence for me that the message we see in the Bible was inspired by a being that transcends the dimensions of length, width, height, and time, whereas these other holy books simply had the signature of being written by a being that was constrained by the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. So that was a big factor in my recognizing the Bible was unique. It was the unique, inspired word of God. Now, the talk I'm giving you today, I've given in front of children, mainly because children seem to get this a lot easier than adults do. And I've actually got a theory to explain why, because, you know, my wife says that I'm a compulsive experimenter. My parents said that too. And I did experiments on my boys when they were 3 months, 6 months, 7 months. And what I discovered was this, that they actually transitioned from two-dimensional thinking to three-dimensional thinking between the time of about 4 months and 7 months. Their brain had switched over. And, you know, I got to explain this material to my sons when they were 4 years of age. They were only 3.5 years removed from that transition from two-dimensional thinking to three-spatial dimensional thinking. Most of you have been in a three-dimensional rut for 40, 50, 60 years. And so it's much more difficult to get you to think beyond the dimensions than it is with children. But you can get this DVD. It's over there at the table, Beyond the Cosmos. It's basically something you can show to teenagers and young people, older people too for that matter, so that they can communicate this material with others. But a couple of books I've written in addition to Beyond the Cosmos, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Basically explaining how God is going to bring us from these limited four space-time dimensions into many more dimensions. You say, why is God constraining us to just four space-time dimensions now? God has created this universe as a tool to permanently eliminate evil and suffering. And for that to work, he must temporarily constrain us to the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. But once evil is no longer a factor, then God can deliver us from the chains of four space-time dimensions to experience many more. And what I write about in Why the Universe is the Way It Is are the relationships we can expect to experience a new creation where we're no longer constrained by length, width, height, and time. Kind of explaining why we see in Corinthians, no one can think or imagine how great and wonderful it will be, because your relationships will no longer be in linear time, they're going to be in geometric time, and never mind all the space stuff. But let me end with what I think is the most stunning transdimensional doctrine you'll find in the pages of Scripture. And it refers to the crucifixion of Christ. Because if you read the four Gospels, what you discover is that Jesus of Nazareth spent between 6 and 9 hours on the cross. And what skeptics have pointed out, how can a man dying on the cross for only 6 to 9 hours pay the atonement penalty for all the sins and offenses of every human being that has ever lived? Well, it's not just a human being that was dying on the cross, it was God. In the incarnation, the second person of the Trinity was simultaneously God and man. And therefore, unlike us, his suffering need not be constrained to just the single dimension of time in which we're operating. Now, I'm not claiming this is exactly how God paid the redemptive price, but I'm making the point, it's no longer a physical impossibility. In 6 to 9 hours, the second person of the Trinity really can suffer the equivalent penalty that every human being who ever lived deserves based on their sin and evil and rebellion against God. So what I want you to visualize here is the second person of the Trinity hanging on the cross, but experiencing multiple dimensions of a time. So that black line you see there, think of it as a line coming out from behind the screen and forward. And then along the plane of the screen, we have Jesus experiencing a second dimension of time. And then in that second dimension of time, I want you to visualize 130 billion. You say, why 130 billion? That's kind of a rough estimate of how many human beings have ever lived since God created Adam and Eve. But in that third dimension of time, we can have Christ suffering for infinite time on 130 billion parallel lines of time. And so think of that, 130 billion infinitely long parallel lines of time where Christ is suffering the atonement penalty for each one of us. Because what's our atonement penalty? That we would be experiencing torment for all eternity. And how that can be compressed in from three dimensions of time down into just the 6 to 9 hours that Christ suffered on the cross. It's one way. I'm not saying it is the way, but it's a way that we can conceive of how Jesus in just 6 to 9 hours can pay for an eternity of torment for billions of human beings that have lived since God created Adam and Eve. And I'd like to close with Hebrews 2:3. How shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? I have found that many scientists and lay people have refused the offer of what Christ has made available for us on the cross because they haven't measured the atonement price that he paid. And I think that's the challenge of Hebrews 2:3. If we actually measure what Christ did for us on the cross, how can anyone in their right mind turn down such a magnificent offer that Christ has made to trade his moral perfection for our moral imperfection? With that, I'll take the remainder of time we have for questions. And by the way, this is being live streamed, so we'll also be taking questions from the live streaming audience. But I'll give the first chance to those of you who are here in person. And the rule in the Q&A time is this. You can ask any question you want on any subject you want. That doesn't have to be about the lecture. Any subject, but we do have one rule. If you've got 6 questions, you take 6 separate turns. And it's no fair to ask me a 4-part question. If you've got a 4-part question, that's 4 turns that you take because we want to give people the opportunity. I saw a hand over here, yes.
I just want to make sure that people speak up because we are recording it. This thing isn't working, so if you could repeat the question,
okay,
appreciate it.
That'd be good.
You said in Genesis chapter the first, when God created the heavens and the earth, there was a Hebrew word for created. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, she's asked me if I could repeat the Hebrew word that's used in Genesis 1:1 for create. It's the word bara. It transliterated in English B-A-R-A. And it's used only three times in Genesis 1, and we actually got three separate talks in each one of them. First time you see it is for the creation of the universe. That's the physical creation. The second time you're going to see it is on creation day 5, when God creates the soulish animals. Animals that are not purely just purely physical, but physical and soulish. The third time you see it is when God creates human beings, the one and only species that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. And so God has created these animals. That's going to be the talk next week about God creating these soulish animals. And say, why did God create them? He created them with a capacity to relate to and serve and please a higher species, all of us human beings. Likewise, he created us to relate to and serve and please a higher being. The soulish animals can't do that, but we can. But it uses the word bara. Why? Because it's something brand new that never existed before. Okay, good question. Anyone else?
Could you please,
yes.
Who created God,
and what did you want me to explain about who created God? Or just kind of go over that again?
If possible.
Yeah.
I think I didn't grasp it.
Okay. Yeah. A common question, in fact, in the debate that Richard Dawkins had, he asked that question. Okay, if God created the universe, who created God? If you have to fine-tune the universe, who fine-tunes God? And it's a category error. He was assuming that God is constrained just like we are, that he was constrained in space and time like we are, in which case he would need a creator. In fact, that's a very simple argument for creation. Any entity constrained to a single dimension of time, where time cannot be stopped or reversed, must have a beginning, must be created. So that means that ultimately everything in the universe itself, must be traceable back to a creation event. But an entity that's not constrained by a single dimension of time is not under that restriction. And the space-time theorems actually prove that we got cause and effect going on before the beginning of cosmic time. Therefore, the creator, at a minimum, must have access to at least the equivalent of a second dimension of time. And as I demonstrated in my little thing with the two dimensions of time, in that context, God is no beginning, no ending. He is not created. But I begin by pointing out it's a category error when you say, well, okay, then God is restrained just like us. He's not. He created time.
The mic is working now, so I'll pass it to...
Okay, we got a gentleman in the back here.
All right.
Using your example of Mr. and Mrs. Flat, can you tell us what their ability to observe you as the three-dimensional being would be, or would they be unable to observe you?
Okay, in the context of Mr. and Mrs. Flat, who are constrained to two dimensions of space, the only way they can see me is if I come into their plane. If I don't come into their plane, it's impossible for them to see or touch me. And that's what Paul was explaining in 1 Timothy 6, that it's impossible to see God or touch God unless he comes in to our dimensional realm, which is what happened when the second person of the Trinity chose to come here as a baby and live amongst us as a human being. As it says in Philippians 2, he humbled himself, he lowered himself, and took the form of a human being. So he temporarily divested himself of the powers he had as a creator of the universe. I mean, to me, that's humbling. The one who created the entire universe and created us decided to come and live amongst us, show us example of perfect morality and humility, and then offer himself as a sacrifice so that all of us can be delivered from something we can't deliver ourselves. Over here. Oh, we got another one over here. All right.
It says in 1 Samuel that the Lord regretted that he made Saul king over Israel. So if God predestined everything to happen, he had regrets.
Very good question. I get that all the time on my Twitter page from atheist scientists. You know, what about these passages where it talks about God regretting what he did? Well, you know, we are soulish beings. We have emotions. And those emotions come from a creator that also has emotions. And so what you see in the Bible repeatedly is God expressing the emotions he feels. And just for example, like a human parent feels emotion when they see their child going down a path that they know is not to their benefit. You feel that grief, you feel that pain, you feel that regret for what they're experiencing. And so God expresses that. And so it's not that God doesn't know what's going on or doesn't predestine everything, but at the same time, he has emotions. So when he sees you going down a path that he knows is not for your benefit, he will experience deep emotional grief over what he sees you doing. But also when he sees you going down a path that is right, he experiences great joy and happiness, and he expresses that. And so, and just like, for example, parents will say things to their children. It's like, you know, a good place to go would be Genesis 4, where you got Cain murdering his brother Abel, and God asked Cain a whole bunch of questions. And it's like, well, gee, doesn't God know the answers already? He does. But just like a wise parent, when they see their child doing something wrong, will try to ask questions in order to get that child to recognize what they should have done, God does the same thing with us. And so, yeah, we need to look at the context in each case. But, yeah, great question over here.
Yeah, the question was, there are indications from physics what the attributes of the causation of the universe must be in terms of access to time and dimension. In fact, there's an approximation of the number of dimensions that's minimally available in order to create the universe. But what about indications within the physical observations indicate personality?
Okay. What I've been focusing on in today's talk is the scientific evidence we have for a transcendent creator, a creator beyond space and time. What I'm going to be doing in the talk I'll be giving 2 weeks from today, it's basically a talk titled How the Cosmos Reveals Christ. Not just the existence of God, but the existence of a personal God, the existence of a redeeming God. And so when I'm sharing my faith, for example, with unbelieving scientists, I've first given the evidence that there's a God beyond the universe that created the universe. Step two, I answer your question. How do we look at the characteristics of the universe and demonstrate that that transcendent God is a personal being? And what you're going to see me doing is using the fine-tuning argument. They look at the extent and the degree of fine-tuning. It's clear that this must be a personal being. In fact, what I'm going to do in the talk 2 weeks from today is compare the fine-tuning design that God put into the universe with the very best example of fine-tuning designs that we humans have achieved, basically drawing the conclusion that the one that created the universe must be a lot better educated, more intelligent, with a lot more financial resources than we human beings. And that's only possible for a personal being. But I'm going to end the talk by saying, not only can we use the physics to demonstrate that there's a personal God, we can use the physics to show that it's a redeeming God, a God that created the universe with the intent of redeeming humanity, those of us who so choose, from the evil that we feel compelled to perform, how God will deliver us into moral purity. In fact, that's what, to me, is where you get the greatest fine-tuning evidence of all. The universe is fine-tuned, not only in a way that demonstrates a personal being, but in a way that makes possible the redemption of billions of human beings. Okay, got a question here?
Yep.
One back here. Okay.
You can be next. Hugh, as a Christian, one of the two verses that give me the greatest hope is Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. You can't go there now, but you can come later. And other verses that talk about that same place as having no more pain, suffering, and evil in it, referring to the new creation. So the question, obviously, is that we've just talked about the space-time dimensions of this universe, the ones that God operates in the new creation, or any of the current dimensions going to be in the new creation, or do you think God creates all new dimensions in space there, or how does that fit in? Because when you say beyond the cosmos, it's interesting for me. The first thing I always think of is the new creation,
right,
as opposed to this one.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that's really the culmination of both why the universe is the way it is and beyond the cosmos. Chapter 15 and beyond the cosmos, chapter 13 and why the universe is the way it is, I try to give you a picture of what life in the new creation will be like, what the dimensions are going to be like, what the laws of physics will be like. For example, it's explicit in Revelation 21 and 22. It's going to be a realm where there's no gravity. You won't have to worry about your chin sagging as you get older and older because there's no gravity to make it sag. There's no electromagnetism. You're not going to have to worry about your skin wrinkling as you get older because there's no electromagnetic radiation. And there is no second law of thermodynamics. Nothing will decay. For all you men there in the audience, you won't have to maintain what you create. Zero maintenance. You just think of what life is going to be like, where you're going to spend all of your time creating and none of your time maintaining. Now, it's also going to be true of relationships. We're going to be able to focus on creating relationships without having to maintain them. I mean, notice we go through refining fire before we enter the new creation. You want to know what that refining fire is all about? It basically takes away from you everything that's obnoxious. So when you enter the new creation, everyone you meet is going to be the most fascinating person you can possibly engage eternity with. You're going to want to spend eternity with them because everyone's gone through the refining fire. As it says in 1 Corinthians 3, some of us have to go through a little more fire than others. But we all come through it pure. And it's a realm where we're no longer constrained by length, width, height, and time. At a minimum, God's going to release us into the equivalent of two dimensions of time. One of the things that depressed me when I gave my life to Jesus Christ was wondering, okay, when I get to the new creation, my name is Ross, I'm close to the end of the alphabet. I actually calculated how many millions of years I'd have to wait before I'd be able to have a private office appointment with the Apostle Paul. I mean, I thought, I got a lot of questions I want to ask him. But what I realized, having studied Revelation and Romans and other texts, God's going to give the Apostle Paul a capacity to hold simultaneous, one-on-one, private, intimate conversations with billions of human beings. And he's going to enable us to do that for all of us, which is why there is no marriage in the new creation. It's not necessary. As I explained to my wife, we're going to be in continual, uninterrupted fellowship for the rest of eternity in the new creation. She says, I'm not too excited about that. I reminded her, look, I'm going to be going through the refining fire. She says, okay, well, if that's the case, then I think I can handle that. But the whole point is, we're going to be able to do that with every other being in the new creation simultaneously. So there's no need for families or marriages because we're all one gigantic family. And who knows how many dimensions of space, but we're told it's going to be limitless exploration. You know, right now I'm involved in a debate with a theologian who thinks our eternal home is this planet Earth. And I said, well, if it's this planet Earth, it's going to be extremely crowded. There's going to be 30 billion of us running around. And, I like the idea of saying being able to go up Half Dome. You know, I thought about that 40 years ago, but I says, forget it. Because you know what going up Half Dome is like? Single file all the way up, where all you see is the shirt of the guy ahead of you. I mean, what's the fun of that? But it tells us that God's going to release us into a new creation, a new earth, with a new Jerusalem that sits on the new earth, where the minimum living space of that new Jerusalem is more than 8 times the entire surface area of planet Earth. And so, yeah, you're going to be able to explore for the rest of eternity. Your bucket list will be infinite, whereas a bucket list for a planet Earth is somewhat finite. Okay, who's next? over here. Yes.
If you could please stand up. In Psalm 19, it starts out by saying that the heavens declare the glory of God. And for any of us who have gone camping, you're out underneath the stars, you see the Milky Way, the way it's supposed to be seen because you're away from a city, and you're just in awe. But that's not true for everybody. Why is that?
Okay. The heavens declare the glory of God. What you're going to hear next week from Dave back there is how God teaches us through the birds and the mammals. And in many respects, those of us living in the 21st century, including those of us with doctoral degrees in the science, are more ignorant about science than people lived 4,000 years ago. Yeah, you go up into the mountains, you look at the sky, it's fantastic, it's awesome, but it's nowhere near as awesome as when Abraham looked up. No matter where you go in the world today, there's enough light pollution that you don't get to see the full glory of the heavens the way people 4,000 years ago did. When Abraham looked up at the sky, he could see over 15,000 stars. Even in a really dark sky location here in North America, you can see maybe 6,000 or 7,000. Still spectacular, but Abraham was completely blown away. So, and less than half of the world's population today has ever seen the Milky Way. And if you're in downtown Shanghai or Beijing, the heavens are declaring Zippo. You don't see anything. So, in fact, we entertained a young woman from China, and she said, "What's that in the sky?" And I said, "That's the moon." She had not seen the moon low on the horizon. She'd seen it up high, but she had never seen it low on the horizon. You know, when it's low on the horizon, it has the appearance of being quite a bit bigger. It really isn't. It's an optical illusion. But she had never seen that sight before. And likewise, the vast majority of human beings have not had intimate contact with wild birds and mammals who have not been abused by human beings. I write about this in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, about my experiences in the wilds of Canada, where I knew the animals there had not had a contact with a human being in over 50 years. They behave very differently. And yeah, the lessons that Job talks about that these animals teach you, you can see that when you have that kind of contact. But how many people in the world today have had that experience? I know I'm in the extreme minority because it's very difficult to actually go to places where animals have not had that abuse factor by human beings. But I can tell you this, they're drawn to us. What the Bible says, how God designed them to come to us and relate to us and to serve and please us. I mean, I was setting up my little pup tent, and right away, within 2 hours, I had this kind of circle of animals around me, watching me, curious. Next morning, several of them were inside my pup tent. And they actually wanted physical contact with me. Okay, but what does the Bible say? It's our sin that causes these animals that God designed to come to us to run away from us. Likewise, our sin causes us, instead of coming to God, to run away from Him, or to pretend He doesn't exist. So yeah, there's many lessons that these animals are designed to teach, but the vast majority of human beings today have no exposure to those lessons. Explains why, for example, when I've done missionary trips in rural Africa, I never met an atheist. But when I'm in big metropolitan cities, they're all over the place. The atheists I've publicly debated have all been urbanites. So yeah. Come to the next week's lecture. It'll be different than the one I teach, but hey, it's going to be live animals. Who's next?
When you were mentioning that the universe is the physical, and that animals are soulish and physical.
Some animals are. Yeah.
And people, humans, are physical, soulish, and spiritual. Is it the soul that lives on eternally?
Okay. A good caveat there is that there's a debate amongst Christians, theologians. Are we humans tripartite? Are we three parts or two parts? My personal position is that the soul of a human being can't be separated from the spirit of a human being. And so we are dualists. We have a physical body and we have a non-physical component, our soul slash spirit. But there are theologians who believe you can separate the soul from the spirit, but I'm not one of them. I think the soul and the spirit are inseparable. And I think there's good evidence for that from what we see about the dead in Christ mentioned in the New Testament epistles, how they're aware of what's going on here on earth. They experience emotions while they're up there in the new creation. And so they're alive spiritually and soulishly, just not physically, but a time will come when they'll be granted a physical body that is incorruptible. It won't decay. Got another question? Incidentally, we can take questions from the virtual audience as well if they're coming in.
I want to know about when God caused the sun to stand still, the scientific explanation of that, and did that have any effect, like, after that happened?
Sure. Well, if you want a complete answer, I did a television documentary on that very question. And it did get recorded, and you can get it at thereasons.org store. And we also look at Jonah and the fish, as well as what happened with Joshua on the long day. There's a rumor that's been running around for 45 years now that scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and several of those JPL engineers and scientists participate in the paradoxes class here, with us. But the rumor is that they used their supercomputers and proved Joshua's long day. And the reason the rumor has persisted for so long is that technically it could be done. If you had solar eclipse measurements from before Joshua's long day, you could predict future solar eclipses. And you could use solar eclipses today and predict when they were in the past, and technically you could demonstrate whether or not there's been a one-day discrepancy between the two sets of measurements. Here's the problem. The ancients, before Joshua's long day, did report solar eclipses, but they reported them as follows. A solar eclipse took place on this day. That's not enough timing accuracy to either prove or disprove Joshua's long day. It comes tantalizingly close when we're looking at Hezekiah's sundial, because before Hezekiah's sundial, people were recording the location and the timing of solar eclipses with greater precision. And there was a paper published in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society where they thought they found a 38-minute discrepancy, which is really close to the biblical 40 minutes. But the error bar was plus or minus 5 or 6 minutes. That's not enough to prove or disprove it. So if you heard that rumor, we can't prove it, we can't disprove it. But in terms of what's going on in the text, you need to look at it in the context of the Hebrew words and keep in mind that biblical Hebrew is a very much smaller vocabulary than English words. English is the largest vocabulary language that has ever existed, over 4 million words. Half of them are biochemical terms. So when our biochemist teaches in the class here, you might think he's speaking in tongues, but no, it's just those biochemical terms. Biblical Hebrew, by contrast, only a little bit more than 3,000 words if you don't count the names of people and cities. And so you need to look at it. And what basically the text is telling us is that God imposed over the valley of Ajalon. And my wife and I have visited that valley. It's a valley ringed by hills, relatively small valley. That's where the battle took place. And it tells us that God imposed an extra period of light, which is how most English translations put it, or darkness. And Hebrew scholars I've consulted claim that it's more likely that God imposed extra darkness than extra light. But both are possible, given the Hebrew words that are used there. And the reason why they think extra darkness, that would make more sense because the Valley of Ajalon is a very hot, dry place. And that having extra darkness would keep the troops cool enough that they could continue the battle, whereas extra light wouldn't make all that much difference. So And also, when it talks about the sun standing still, it's basically telling us that there was either extended light or extended darkness. The text is saying nothing about the actual movements of the sun, moon, and earth. It's simply referring to the meteorological context that there is either an extra period of darkness that kept the place dark for the equivalent of a whole day, or an extra period of light that kept it light for the equivalent of a whole day. Now, in terms of getting a period of darkness that lasts a whole day, that would require a meteorological event that would be extremely rare in that part of the Negev Desert. You know, where I grew up in coastal British Columbia, it was quite common that we would get those storms where it would be as dark as night in the middle of the day. But to get that in the Negev Desert, that's an outright miracle that you could get that. But it doesn't require God transcending the laws of physics to make it happen. He would obviously have to control the laws of physics in a miraculous way. As I explained in the television documentary, a more outstanding miracle is what happened at the time of Hezekiah, where the shadow of the sundial went back 40 minutes. Because the text tells us that miracle was also observed in Babylon. And the Babylonians sent a delegation to Jerusalem, which I find fascinating. Here are these Babylonians seeing this miracle in Babylon, and what's their conclusion? This isn't Marduk. This is the real God. We better go to Jerusalem and see what's going on. So evidently they recognize the God of Israel really is the one true God, and they came to investigate. But that means that the shadow, the sundial, went back 40 minutes at both locations, and they're separated by 600 miles. We're no longer talking a small valley. We're talking an extended region. And therefore, I point out this might actually be a miracle that transcends the laws of physics. For example, God shining his Shekinah glory upon both sundials to move the shadow back the appropriate minute. I mean, that's one way it could have been done. But if you want the details, you can get our, it's a two-hour television documentary where we discuss four different events recorded in the Old Testament that skeptics call and say, this can't possibly be the case. It actually can, if you understand the context correctly.
Here we have an online,
question
from Lucas. He wants to ask, do virtual particles cause problems with creation ex nihilo?
Do virtual particles cause problems for ex nihilo creation? Well, you can go at reasons.org and just put into the search engine Lawrence Krauss. He was the one that wrote a whole book about how we don't need God to create the universe. We can create it out of nothing. But I wound up writing a couple of reviews of his book, making the point that every one of his definitions of nothing is actually something. Virtual particles are particles that arise from the quantum space-time fluctuations in the space-time fabric of the universe. Just like you can convert matter into energy and energy into matter, you can also take quantum space-time fluctuations and make matter out of it. However, the principles of quantum mechanics tells us that before the human observer can actually detect and grab one of those virtual particles, it goes back into the quantum space-time fluctuations. But we know from measurements that this phenomenon is actually occurring. These virtual particles are coming into existence all the time, but they rapidly go back into the quantum space-time fluctuation. Now, people like Lawrence Krauss try to claim, well, if that can happen for the virtual particle, maybe that's how the whole universe comes into existence. But another principle of quantum mechanics is the greater the mass that you pull of the quantum space-time fluctuation, the faster it must return to the quantum space-time fluctuation. Now, something as massive as the observable universe, how long can it last before it returns to the quantum space-time fluctuation? Less than 10 to the minus 120 seconds. So that's less than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth, a few more trillionths of a second. And I think all of you here are old enough to actually refute that hypothesis for how the universe came into existence. But if you want to read the details, I'd suggest getting those two reviews that are up on our reasons.org website. Okay, I think, I hope you're controlling the time, because I don't want, we are, okay.
Probably two more questions.
Two more questions, okay.
I'm curious, given all the evidence that we have and that we're gaining every day that God exists, what are the biggest arguments that you find from the atheists out there for realizing it?
Very good question. And this is why in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, I added a chapter that was not in the third edition, basically making the point that we're seeing the biblical principle, especially in Job and Psalms, that the more we learn about the universe, the more we learn about God's created realm, the more evidence we find for the supernatural handiwork of the Creator God. If you want to know why we keep coming up with new editions of our books, it reasons to believe, it's to demonstrate the principle that the more we scientists discover, the stronger the case we get for the supernatural handiwork of the Creator. But what has happened is that that trend has become so pervasive and so dramatic that scientists who are taking a non-theistic perspective are now resorting to non-empirical arguments for their atheism. They're basically saying, well, that's just what we know from what we can conclude from what we know. What about that which we don't know? So, for example, a favorite approach of non-theistic scientists is to say, well, our measurements tell us nothing about the quantum gravity era. How many of you have ever heard of quantum gravity? Okay? Have you ever been engaging these atheists? That's what you're hearing all the time. And what they're referring to is that we don't have measurements that tell us what the characteristics of the universe were like when it was less than 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. And therefore, maybe things were so different from what we see today, we're not stuck with the space-time theorems. So, for example, over there at Caltech, a few miles away, Sean Carroll has published what he calls the quantum eternity theorem. But he's basically speculating that quantum space-time fluctuations at that time in the universe where we have no measurements to tell us what's going on are so large we can escape the conclusion of the space-time theorems, which is why I put in The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition, some new observations by astronomers where they're actually able to penetrate that quantum gravity era very slightly. Basically, what we know is that the images of distant quasars at short wavelengths will magnify those space-time fluctuations of the quantum gravity era. And if they're very large, it will blur the images. We see no blurring, which tells us that those quantum space-time fluctuations are not large enough to allow an escape from the space-time theorems. But it's something that I think will continue. You say, is that going to stop the non-theists? No, they'll find another way where they can say, well, we don't know this. Maybe we can speculate and escape God here. But philosophically, I think we have to argue for our worldview based on what we know, not based on what we don't know. For example, I could use a similar line of philosophical reasoning to argue that my wife, who I've been married to for 40 years, doesn't really exist. It's possible, for example, I've been fooled these 40 years by a very sophisticated three-dimensional hologram. But I'm not really seeing her. I'm really just seeing this sophisticated. There's been movies made like this, like The Matrix. You know, we're all been fooled by this stuff. However, all of the observations and experiments I've made my wife establish that she's not a hologram. She's a real physical being. And the whole point is, every year I'm married, the evidence for that gets stronger and stronger. Yet I still lack absolute proof that my wife is a physical being. I never will have absolute proof. If the atheist is challenging you and saying, I will not believe until I have absolute proof, say, you can never get that. We humans are constrained to the space-time dimensions of the universe. And it was Kurt Gödel, the German philosopher, proved in 1930 that since we're so constrained, we can't come up with absolute proof for anything. But that doesn't mean we don't have practical proof. And so I would just challenge these atheists who use those arguments, you need to be philosophically consistent. You can't use one set of philosophical principles for your wife, your work, and your engagement in work, and something completely different from the one that created the universe. You need to have a consistent worldview. And it's challenging to have a consistent worldview where I think you can get them out of that mind lock. But evidently, it simply exposes there are other reasons rather than intellectual reasons for why they take that position. And what I've discovered over the years is the atheist scientists I debate who are really stuck in their atheism, unwilling to reconsider, they got other reasons. And typically those reasons boil down to they've been abused at some point by a significant Christian in their life, and they're not able to forgive that Christian. As it says in Matthew 7, if you will not forgive others, I cannot forgive you. Why? Because no one has been offended more than the creator of the universe. And to measure a human offense against the offense we committed against God is simply irrational. Okay, do we have time for one more?
No, we're out of time.
We're out of time. All right.
Such an excellent answer. Yeah.
Okay.
I want to thank everybody for coming. Just so you know, Dr. Ross teaches a class here at Christ Church, Paradox class at 10:45 every Sunday when he's not out of town. So if you can't get enough of this, there's more.
And we live stream all the classes.
That's right, on paradoxes.org. So we will see you in 2 weeks. And I want to thank everybody for being here.